Hello, and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts here, Dana Osman, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masechta Bava Metzia, daf Vav, page 6. We have an interesting case here that Rabbi Zeira presents, which asks the following question. By Rabbi Zeira. So Rabbi Zeira asks, Takafa Echad Bifaneinu. So we have this, you know, case of two people who are holding the same cloak or the same article of clothing, and each one says, it's mine, right? And then what happens is one of them sort of snatches the cloak from the other person before they get to the judges. So only he is holding it up. Mahu, what is the law? Do we let him keep the whole cloak or do we take it from him and say that it needs to be divided the way that the Mishnah taught us? So the Gemara asks some more clarifying questions. Hechi dami, right? What are the circumstances of this question? Idishatik, if he, the one from who the cloak was taken, was silent, meaning he didn't protest, udie odile. So then he basically admitted that the cloak is the other person's, meaning the person who's fully holding the cloak. V'idakat savach, but if he started to protest, my havele lema'avad, right? What should he have done? In other words, what more, he's not expected to like start punching him or hitting him, right? So basically he's going to have to rely on the court, which is what he was going to have to do anyways to fix this situation. So the Gemara says, lo, okay, Rabbi Zeira is not asking, you know, sort of a superfluous question here. Tzricha deshatik me'ikara v'hadar tzavach. It's a case where he, the one who the cloak was taken from, was silent at first, and then he began to protest. So in other words, he's silent when the cloak, some of the mafarshim explain when it's, you know, pulled away from him, but he starts to protest as soon as it leaves his hands. My, what's the halacha in this case? Do we say that since he was silent when the cloak was taken, he admitted it to, you know, that it was the other person's cloak? Or perhaps because he's now protesting, it's evident that the reason he was silent in the first place is that he thought, but the rabbis see what my opponent is doing, so I don't need to protest. In other words, they're going to see that he grabbed it, you know, and wasn't behaving well. And, you know, they're still going to make judgment the way that they need to. So the Gemara answers this and says, Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Toshma, come and learn. And he quotes a brisa here, which he thinks will add to, you know, our Mishnah's ruling about that you would take this cloak and basically divide it in half. Bamed Zavarim Amarim, what circumstances does this ruling apply? Shnishnehen Adukin Ba, when both litigants are holding the cloak. But if the cloak is in the possession of one of them, right? The burden of proof rests on the one who seeks to exact property from the possession of his fellow. So in other words, the cloak is basically going to be kept by the person who's holding it unless the other party who it was pulled from can, you know, demonstrate or show some type of, something which would be, some type of proof, which would be like bringing witnesses. So Rav Nachman now says, okay, how does the brisa answer Rabbi Zeira's question? Hey, chidami, right? What are the circumstances of this brisa? Inami kediktani. If we say the brisa is as it's taught, that we're talking about litigants who come into the court where only one of them is holding the cloak, pshita, it's obvious, right? Because we know that the burden of proof is going to rest on the person who wants to take property from the other person. Ela shetekafa echa bifaneinu. Rather, it must be this case that Rabbi Zeira came up with, right? That both were holding the cloak when they entered the court, and then one snatched it from the other before the judges. And that person who was snatched from was silent at first, and then he protested. So the brisa basically tells us that the court doesn't remove the cloak from the one who sees it, and this, you know, is the solution to Rabbi Zeira's question. Gemara doesn't like this. Lo, right? This isn't really the case that the brisa refers to. It's not Rabbi Zeira's case. Hacha b'mayaskinan. What are we dealing with here? Kagon de'atu l'kaman k'detifsu la travaihu. The brisa refers to a case where both of them were holding the cloak when they came before the judges. V'amrinan l'hu, and we said to them, zilu plogu, go and divide the cloak between yourselves. V'nafgu, and they went out to divide the cloak. V'hadar atu bi tafis le'chad minhu, and when they came back, only one of them was holding it. Hi Amar, this one, the one who's holding it, says, odi, odei, Odili. He admitted to me that the cloak is mine, meaning the person who's not holding the cloak. Baha Amar, and the one who isn't holding the cloak, says, Bidami agarit nihale. He's holding it because I rented it to him for payment. But really, the cloak is mine. And that's really the case of the Braisa. So the Braisa is basically teaching us that who's ever holding the cloak, that's whose property it's considered to be. Da amrinan leis, because we say to them, ad hashta chashta leg begazlan, until now you suspected your opponent of being your thief, of being a thief. Vahashta mugarat lay below sadi. But now you rented it to him without witnesses, right? So that's like, that doesn't make any sense. First you said he was a thief and now you were willing to rent it to him. So therefore we assume that the person holding the cloak, his is actually the valid one. And you would have to bring some type of witness, some type of other proof to say otherwise. Gemara then has another explanation of the Braisa. V'bais ema kediktani. If you want, you could say that the Braisa should be understood as it was taught. Da'atu lekaman ki tafis lachad minhu. Right? It's a case where one of the litigants was holding the cloak when they came before the judges. V'idach misrach ba sruchei. However, the other one was in the act of wrestling, of trying to get it from him, right? And still the Braisa is teaching us that the cloak is still the property of the person who's holding it. Va'afilu l'sumchus, and even according to Sumchus, da'amar mamon ha'mutal b'safik cholkim b'lo shvu'al, who says that money whose ownership is in doubt is divided between the litigants without them having to take an oath, moda sumchus t'sircha lav klum hi. Because Sumchus concedes that the act of resting the cloak is not a demonstration, it's not showing possession to it at all. So in other words, even though Sumchus is more likely to say that disputed property should just be divided and you don't need to take a shfua, right? Because we saw that, Sumchus ruled, this was a few dapim ago, that the case of our Mishnah, that the cloak is divided between the two litigants without them having to take an oath. However, with this interpretation of the Braisa, right, even in this case, Sumchus would agree that the cloak is not divided because it's not considered to be the property of the person who's trying to grab it back. And he would agree, right, what he only disagrees about with the rabbis is in clear cases of doubt. When there's a clear case of doubt, you divide, but you don't need to do a shvua. Whereas the rabbis would say maybe you do need to take a shvua. So we have these, I don't know. I can't tell how practical these things are. Like, I'm really trying to picture people showing up to court, each holding a corner of a garment or one pulling it away from the other. I think what the Gemara is really trying to tease out here is, or sort of what are the boundaries of possession? And I think the main point here is, by bringing this Braisa, is to express that once somebody actually has the object in their full reshut, in their full possession, it's really theirs. And the other person really needs to come to explain why they have any claim to that object at all. From here, the Gemara is going to get onto a very interesting case, which is what if one of them makes the, if they're both walked into the court with this cloak and then one of them dedicated, their half, to the Beit HaMikdash. So pay attention to that as well. But again, I think the real discussion here is about the boundaries of ownership and that can you be considered an owner when the object is completely not in your jurisdiction at all? And the answer is no. You have to bring the burden of proof in that case.
What's that expression? Possession is 9/10 of the law, something like that. I mean, I think that's really talking about squatting in a real estate. But I think it's really interesting how here the claim is, or the position is, that if you're not holding on to it, if you don't have it in your physical possession, then you have to prove that you own it. One of the reasons I think that I find that particularly interesting nowadays is because nowadays I think that's maybe less of the case, right? If you think about NFTs, which I know nothing about, right? But if you think about the way we've got ownership of copyright issues, right? Intellectual property. We have ownership of property or items that are far away from us. I'm curious, how would the Gemara, how would the sages have treated those kinds of cases? Certainly, they understand. I'm sure they understand, the idea of two homes, right? They have people traveling back and forth between Israel and Bavel. But these other things are far more abstract. And to lay claim of ownership, when we talk about kinyanim, right, the way that we acquire ownership, you know, most of those ways are physically tangible kinds of acts of acquisition, right? You pick it up, you know, pull your animal so that it walks and now it's in your possession. And the one thing I think that stands out as a more symbolic kind of act of kinyan, an act of acquisition, is what's called kinyan sudar or chalipin, right? This idea that, you know, you take a hold of someone's object that belongs to them, that represents the other real thing that you're really taking possession of. We do this before Pesach, right? There's an act, a symbolic act of transfer of a small item, you know, in the rabbi's study type of thing, that then represents all of the chametz that people are going to be selling. So I don't have anything more than a puzzle to raise here. I don't have an answer. But I think that the phenomenon of ownership being a very physical, tangible thing, to the extent that you'd have to prove that you were the owner if you didn't have possession, is maybe less directly our experience today. All right, I want to continue on the bottom of Amud Aleph. We've got, it's a related case to everything that you've been discussing here, Dina. Im timtulomar takafa achad bifaneinu motziino tamiado hektisha eina mekudeshet. So let's say somebody seizes the garment in the presence in court, right? Takes it and takes it fully away from the other party. Now, what happens if this item has been consecrated, and then isn't that a sneaky way to keep the item from the other party? I don't know how it helps you, right? It also takes it out of your own possession. But what it says here is hektisha eina mekudeshet. If they had consecrated the entire item, then that consecration is not valid because the claim, oh, that it's hit, you know, that it belongs to the one party, is contradicted by the other party. So he doesn't have the right to consecrate it. Im timtulomar tkafa achad bifaneinu ein motziino tamiado hektisha belo tkafa mahu. So then the Gemara says, well, one second. If you're saying that the whole idea of somebody grabbing hold of the whole garment in the presence of the court is not going to take it out of that other party's possession, right? So then what would happen if you consecrate the garment without taking hold of it, right? Then what is the halacha? And this is exactly this, you know, embarks on this question of what happens when an item is not in your possession. When do you say that you can have ownership of that or not? So the Gemara is going to present both ways of thinking about this before it delves into how we really want to conclude. And that's going to take us beyond what we can talk about today. Kevan de Mar Mar, once Master Mar, right, that's how he's called, said, Amirato le Gavoa, Kemisirato le Hedyot Dami. Right, the position is that declaring an item, you know, consecrated to le Gavoa, to the Most High, capital M, capital H, right, to God, right? That's equivalent to transfer of ownership to a regular person. So that is, you know, then the point is that isn't that similar to saying that somebody grabbed a hold of it? Isn't that the same kind of thing that the transfer of ownership is supposed to be taking place? Oh, Dilma, right, there's two ways to look at this. Or maybe, Hashtamiha halo takafa. Or maybe because you'd say, the consecration does not take effect, and therefore it's as if he didn't actually grab a hold of the garment. Uktiv v'ish ki yakdish et beito kodesh. This, the proof text here for the discussion comes from Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 27, when a man sanctifies the house, you know, to be holy, to be sanctified. Ma beito birshuto, av kol birshuto. So the same way that the house is in his possession, so too he can sanctify anything that's in his possession. La fuke hadelo birshuto, which then comes to exclude anything that is not actually in his possession. And therefore, claims this view of the Gemara, right? Since he didn't actually take a hold of that garment, it wasn't really in his possession, and consecration did not take effect. The Gemara's got to try to provide a solution. Tashma, come in here. Dahahi, there was an event. Hahi masuta dahavu mitze alei beitre. So there was a bathhouse, and two people were arguing about the bathhouse. Hai amar didihu One said it's mine, and the other said it's mine. This should not surprise anybody. Of course, that's the kind of case we're going to have now. So one of the two of them got up and consecrated this bathhouse. That should already raise, you know, red flags. So Rav Chananya and Rav Hushaya and all of the rabbis stayed away from this bathhouse. They didn't use it because they were now worried that they're, what if it's consecrated? What if that took hold and now they're at risk of, you know, trespassing, violating consecrated property for mundane, profane kind of use. So Rav Hushaya says to Rabba, when you go and you learn with Rav Chista in Kafre, in that place, in that town, ask him what we should do, right? Like, can you imagine what kind of hardship this must have been for the pious people of the town to have to avoid the bathhouse because it might have had the name of sanctified on it? Ki ata l'sura. So Rabba came to the city of Sura on his way to Kafre, I guess. Amarle Rav Hamnuna matnitinhi. So he talks about this case, and Rav Hamnuna says to him, you can find this, you know, this case is going to be in that Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Taharot, chapter 4. Sfek bachorot ve'achad bachor adam ve'achad bachor behema mentorim ment me'im hamotzi me'chavero alav hara'aya. These words you've heard before. The dilemma, if you're not sure when it comes to firstborns, a bechor, whether it's a human firstborn or an animal firstborn, whether you're talking about kosher animals or non-kosher animals, it doesn't matter. All of these cases, that's the phrasing in Hebrew that means the burden of proof rests on the claimant, the person who makes the claim. And there, you know, when we're talking about those kinds of cases, those kinds of animals, right? It says that you can't shear them. You can't, if they're the kind of animal that would need shearing, like sheep. And you're not going to work them because it's not clear whether they have that status as a bechor or not. Vahahacha, so Rav Abdullah explains, and here, right? The amaret kafol kohen, ein motzino tomiado. Here, when we're talking about a case where if, what would happen if a Kohen, a priest, Kohen comes and actually seizes that animal where the Bechor question, right? Is it a Bechor? Is it not a Bechor? It's not clear. So then the court doesn't take it away from the Kohen. The Kohen who has seized that, it's understood that, well, again, Dekatani Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Araya, you know, that somebody would have to, the burden of proof would rest on the person who says, you know, he's not entitled to that. The Kohen is not entitled to that Bechor or possibly Bechor animal. V'chilo t'kafo. And what about the case where, you know, nobody has seized this animal to begin with? Asurin b'gizah u'avodah. You still would then be prohibited from working it or shearing it or whatever. The fact that the Kohen gets to keep the animal, if he seizes it, right, if he takes a hold of it, it doesn't, whatever. The point is that there's still a concern over whether this animal might have been consecrated, in which case you have to be careful with it, how you'd handle it. So then when we come back to our case, you know, what about the bathhouse? So the person who consecrated it didn't really take possession of it in the same way that Kohen might not have taken actual physical possession of the animal per se. So then Rabbi says to him, Amrle Rabbah, Kedushat Bechor Kamarta, Leolam Emelchatz Kafo Kohen Motziino Tom Yado, Vafilo Hachi Asurin Begizau Bavoda, De Kedushah Ba'ame Aleha Shani. Rabbah says, no, Rav Hamnuna. He doesn't say it quite like that, right? He says these cases are not comparable. When you're talking about the Kedusha, the sanctity of the firstborn, right, then, you know, even though you're uncertain whether it's really the firstborn, when the Kohen takes it, then the court is going to remove it from the possession of the Kohen. Because to begin with, taking possession of something by force, by seizing it, already doesn't work to get you possession of it. So that's not a, that's already a separate kind of category. It's not because of a Kohen and consecration, it's because that's not how you take possession to begin with. And even so, you're still prohibited from working the animal or shearing the animal and so on. So the way that Kedusha is manifest as a different kind of case to begin with and not applicable as a potential answer to the bathhouse case. Rav Chananya now comes says, Amar le Rav Chananya le Rabba. He says to Rabba, Tanya de Mesailach, Hasfekot nechasin ledir lehit aser. Well, this lines up, your opinion lines up with the case of indeed, where Cohen takes an animal is not clear if it's a bechor, and then the question is, what are you going to do about tithing? Do you tithe that animal? How does it fit in the question of the halachot that pertain to an animal that's not a firstborn animal, as compared to what if it is a firstborn animal? And so then there's a whole further discussion over what you're supposed to be doing in the case of that animal. And we're going to mostly table this discussion, but I want to, demonstrate how complicated this is, and the bathhouse case is still not answered. The one last thing I want to note is that Abaye jumps in. He's got a whole opinion, and he talks about, how many animals there might be and how the tithing might have worked, and fine. And then, and this I think is just, really, it shows the respect due Abaye, I guess. Hadar Amar Abaye, after Abaye presents that whole theory, he comes back and he says, Lav miltahi de amari. That thing that I said, no, scratch it, forget it. It's not a thing. It's not what I said. It's wrong. And then he goes on to explain why he was wrong. So what I think is valuable here, of course, is the humility of Abaye. The Gemara preserves Abaye's, initial claim, and then also preserves Abaye walking it back. The Gemara, of course, goes on, and we'll pick this up tomorrow.
That's our DAF discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about this DAF on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.